Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast. You know, if you grew up in Southern Maine in the 80s, the 90s, heck, the 70s, any of those decades, you likely cheered for our next guest. He was most popular driver at Beech Ridge a number of times. And he had the stats to back that up, too. 4 track championships. And of course, we'll talk racing. But when you hit the record button, you never know which direction, which street you're going to go down. With Bob, we end up talking about some cool things. Like, I never knew he was a skydiver. Never knew that he was in the band. Some of the stuff that he got into in high school that had nothing to do with racing. And also, Bob, you know, his story, for all the accolades that he achieved as a driver, his story was equally tragic behind the scenes with one of the people who was very instrumental in his success, a gentleman by the name of John McCann. And for those in the Sanford area, you likely know the name John McCann from McCann Randall, MCR. No, not Max Cookson Racing, although we do get into that, too. It's kind of neat how the two worlds intersect. But Bob talks a lot about John and what he meant to him as not only a business partner, but, I mean, a human being in general. And just to listen to John's story, or Bob tell the story, was, I mean, I got choked up a few times, so I think you're going to really enjoy this one. It's not possible without your support. Thank you so much for going to patreon.com/opentrailerpodcast, contributing what you can. These episodes normally drop on a Thursday, but if you are a Patreon member, you'll get them a few days early, so early access for that. If you want to sponsor an upcoming edition of Open Trailer Podcast, hit me up on direct message. We can certainly make that happen. After all, it's a racing podcast, and what's racing without sponsorship? So, again, thank you so much for all of your support, and continue to, you know, I've had a few people check in and say, how do I support Maine Vintage Race Car Association? Thank you for asking that question. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why the podcast still goes, to raise awareness for racing history in the state of Maine, and Maine Vintage do an amazing job of preserving that. And you can go to mainevintagerace.org, that's mainevintagerace.org, and become a member and help preserve history yourself. So Bob has lived a lot of that history, and let's get into it. Stage number one of Bob Randall on Open Trailer Podcast. Left and right. Yeah. Which I think is a great way to begin. Gentleman who is a not only Beech Ridge Motor Speedway Hall of Famer, Maine Motorsport Hall of Famer, class of 2016, over 60 feature wins, including a couple of really big ones, which we'll get to later on in the podcast. But it's an ultimate pleasure to bring Sanford's Bob Randall to the Open Trailer Podcast. Welcome, Bob.
You're welcome.
It's awesome to have you here today. And, you know, we like to talk about the racing stuff. You know, people obviously, whether they grew up around Beech Ridge or racing in the Northeast, you know, they saw you on the racetrack. But, you know, I think sometimes learning about what someone did before they got to the racetrack or what got them to the racetrack is equally as interesting. And you're one of the drivers who I think put Sanford on the map, along with, you know, Bob Turner and some others. Have you always been a Sanford person? Did you grow up there?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Sanford, and I live 10 miles from there now.
You were born in 1951?
50.
So that's around the time that Sanford Speedway was up and going. Did you ever get a chance to check out Sanford Speedway?
No, I never did. I never had any interest in it until I did, which was when I built an engine for Larry Netto and Charlie Leach.
Oh, wow.
And I think it was Yeah, it was in Charlie's car. And after my partner, John McCann, and I built the engine, we said, well, we should go up to the races and see how it goes, you know. So we did that. And, of course, 2 weeks later, we had a daredevil car, was what they called them when I started in the now limited.
Okay, so you actually never went to Sanford Speedway to watch, but we're talking about Beach Ridge.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
No, I never
Have you ever walked the property at Sanford Speedway?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Several times.
Isn't that neat?
Over the years, yeah.
How you can still walk there and still see, you know, like the, not grandstands, but you can see old pieces of wood.
Yeah. In fact, I one of a real good friend of mine who has a large collection of supercars. He had a guy that had found this Sanford Speedway sign, painted sign, which is probably 6 or 8 feet long.
No way.
And he dug it out of the dirt somewhere on that property. And he wanted to sell it, and I don't know, he wanted $500 for it or something. And you know, my friend said, you know, I'd like to have it, but not $500 worth.
Yeah.
And then a few weeks later, the gentleman called him and said, you know what? I'm going to give you that sign. He says, you know, I like it, you know, but not like you'd like it.
Right.
And he says, I would rather see it in your museum, which he has for his cars. I would rather see it there than, you know, playing in my garage collecting dust.
Wow.
And he says, the only stipulation is that if you die before me, I want it back. So he has it up on the entrance to his museum.
Who's this?
Clark Cram.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Well, so you end up at Beach Ridge, you and your partner, John McCann, who I think, you know, a lot of people around Sanford and grew up with your racing. You know, I'm not saying he was the silent partner. You were certainly the man behind the wheel making it happen. But how did you and John first come together?
I was working at the dugout in Sanford.
Dave's dugout?
Yeah.
The sports place?
Yeah, it used to be just the dugout.
Oh.
It used to be on the corner of Main Street and 202.
Oh.
It was on the corner right by. It used to be an Exxon station at the corner there before the Cumberland Farms and urban renewal and everything came along. And I worked there for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. I did outboard repair and, you know, small engine repair. And
how old were you at this point?
I was a freshman or a sophomore in high school, I think.
Yeah.
And then they bought the old Pontiac garage, which is where the dugout, where Dave's dugout was, which is being torn down now.
I know. They're digging out Dave's dugout. I saw that.
Yeah.
I drove by yesterday.
And he was related to the gentleman that owned the store, and he bought into it. So he came into it, and we just got to be great friends.
And how old is John compared to you?
John was 5 years older than me.
Okay, so not much.
Yeah. He passed away in 1980, 35 years old, from melanoma.
Wow.
It was terrible.
Yeah. You guys, you know, you form this partnership, and how does the Daredevil car come into play?
Well, we just, after we went and after we built this motor for Charlie Leach and Larry Nettu, we went to the races once and saw it, and it was like 2 weeks later we had a Daredevil class, a 66 Chevy Impala.
Wow.
With a 283 in it, which we quickly changed to a 327 that we had acquired somewhere. But yeah, I loved it instantly.
Were you interested in any other sports?
No, I never was a ball sport person.
Did you grow up watching races?
Yes. And I grew up, when I was 12, we had a 34 Plymouth in the backyard that my family used to use when I was a child. And my dad got it running. And so I started tearing around the backyard in it and through the woods. And we had a great time with that car.
No seatbelts?
Oh, no. In fact, we sat on a... I think we sat on a wooden box, an old apple crate or something, and we'd go around the corner, we'd fall off it, we'd be hanging on the shifter and the steering wheel.
Who's we? You and who?
Oh, my buddies. You know, we always had people up to go for a ride in it.
Yeah.
One time I had a couple of girls come up.
Of course.
Wanted to impress them.
Yeah.
Well, I'd found this material somewhere in the back seat was bare springs and stuff, so we had wrapped the seats in this stuff, not knowing that it was fiberglass cloth.
Oh, no.
Oh, God.
So you're just like, trying to roll out the red carpet for him, and it's all fiberglass.
So the impressing went to depressing very, very fast. Oh, God.
Were you a ladies' man in school?
Was I what?
Were you a ladies' man in school?
Not really.
Oh.
No. I met my first wife in high school, and we were married for 5 or 6 years. Mm. Never had any children. Got a divorce. No fault of hers at all.
Mm.
I take all blame for that. Alcohol and other things.
Yeah.
And I forgot where we were now.
That's all right. You're impressing women with fiberglass cloth.
Oh, yes.
Probably not.
Yeah.
But, you know, you graduate Sanford High. Do you do any sort of college? Or are you working just at that?
No, I went to SMVTI for automotive tech.
Okay.
In 1969 and 70, I didn't take the degree course. I just took the whatever certificate course or whatever.
Hmm.
But that was a great time. I enjoyed that.
Yeah. What kind of music are you listening to at this point? Who were some of your favorite bands when you were growing up?
That's another thing. My wife laughs at me now because I don't know who Mick Jagger is, I do now.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I always had my head under the hood of a car, you know, or riding around with my buddies, or I was just a car nut from the get-go. I wasn't into ball sports. I listened to music, but I guess I didn't pay enough attention. I didn't get into the who was who or, you know, I know what I liked I played trumpet in the band for years.
Sanford High Band?
Yeah. And then they needed somebody to play the sousaphone, so I transitioned into playing the sousaphone for the last 2 or 3, all through high school anyway. But
you still playing instruments today?
No. Oh. No, just a remote control on a TV.
Yeah. that's cool. Well, let's get back into racing. You know, you get that 327, 67 Plymouth. What are your original results in that race car? Tell me about the first time that you were on the racetrack as a driver.
The first time I raced, I think it may have been Bruce Smith. No, I don't think it was Bruce. I can't remember the guy's name now. But he spun out and I crashed into him and we stove the car up. You know, it was, we fixed it, but that was my first race.
So you crashed in your first race. This is 1974 in the Daredevil division.
That's right. I kept at it, and I kept getting better, or we'll get the car handling better, and all of the above, I guess. But, you know, it's just, it's a thrill that I've never been able to duplicate, other than skydiving. I went skydiving once.
No way. Where? Skydiving?
In Lebanon.
Yeah, those guys are awesome.
And that was a rush. Boy, did I enjoy that. Yeah. If I was had been younger, I would be there every week.
Yeah. But, and you'd be, if it's like racing, you'd be as, that's as financially damaging as racing can be.
Yes.
To go skydiving every week.
I actually, my wife had me have them video me while I was doing it, you know, because I jumped with another guy. Yeah. And it's pretty neat. It was, I was grinning all the time.
The first time I went skydiving, I'll say that, how many times have you been?
Just that once.
Just that once. Yeah, I think that's the best time that you can, that you'll have.
Mm-hmm.
The way that I describe it is it's every emotion you've had rolled into one as you're looking out, they open the door, and then there's just the ground.
Yep.
And then they're like, well, here we go. It's like green flag.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't have any recollections of worrying about jumping out of the airplane.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the worst part of skydiving? Or most exhilarating part of skydiving?
Oh, just the, I think the transition from free falling to being floating under the canopy. Mm. I mean, it was just so still. It was, I think it was November. And it was beautiful out. I mean, it was a beautiful day, and it's just so quiet.
Mm.
And it was, I wanted to do it again. And, you know, my wife and I talked about it. My wife was scared to death to do it.
Yeah.
But she was willing to try it because I enjoyed it so much. Right. But we never did get back to it. But who knows?
They do a wonderful job there, Skydive New England, free plug to them. So in the 74 season, you're running the Daredevil. You guys are getting a little bit better. Is there a couple of drivers at Beechridge, or are there a couple of drivers at Beechridge that you really looked up to in those days?
I mean, of course, in the late models, I, you know, always had, Bob Babb and, Ralph Cusack used to race. And I mean, most all of them were legends to me, you know. But, I can't think of any one particular driver that I was more enthused with than the other.
Yeah.
I liked them all. I still do. We all had our arguments and our whatever. Somebody bumped me or I bumped them. Things happen. And
water under the bridge.
Tempers flare and we all get over it.
Yesterday, I had Rick Zemla interviewed on the podcast, and a couple of times. I'm really glad we're doing this for a few reasons. One of which is the fact that a lot of people have referenced you specifically as a driver they really enjoyed running against and one of the toughest competitors. And Zemla pointed out, he said, we had a couple of times that we didn't really see eye to eye, but we hashed it out. We talked it out, and now everything's good.
Yeah. And it was, a lot of it was other people that stirred things up.
Isn't that weird how that happens?
Got it going. But yeah, Rick and I have always been good buddies. The way I feel about it, and I think he does too.
Yeah. You guys both had a lot of success, especially in the early 80s, which we'll get to. But looking at 1976, I believe that was the first year you moved up into late model sportsman. Where'd you get that car?
I bought it at the Thompson Flea Market. It was a 68 Chevelle, had a 302 engine in it, and I didn't know much about a late model. We pretty much took it and ran it the way it was. And
do you know who that car belonged to before you picked it up?
I don't.
No.
I don't, but on the trip home from picking that car up, something strange had happened, there was a truck somewhere ahead of us that was dropping brand new rolls of copper tubing into the highway. And we went by several of them before we said, what is this? And we stopped and picked up these boxes. They were 3/8 copper tubing, a half inch. And we said, somewhere, somebody's going to be very upset. We never did meet up with the truck, but we had to, I was getting ready to throw out race car parts, so I had room to take them, but we had, 10 boxes of copper tubing.
Wow. So you get home. Is this a car that you and John bought equally?
Yes. Hmm. Yeah.
When does the garage, the MCR garage, come into play?
That came into play well, we started our business in 1971, and initially we had it right next to the dugout in that little cement block building that used to be the Sears tire store, and we ran that there for a few years, and I think it was 1974 when we moved to Springvale at the
Texaco, whatever it is.
Yeah, I don't remember. We were so many different brands over the years, but Gulf, I think it was Gulf.
Yeah.
And that's when we get into it more, and then Alan Mapes, who we rented the place from, he had had complaints about engine noise and whatever.
It's a garage.
Yeah. And, but he thought the stock cars were a little much.
Oh, yeah.
And deterring from the business. So my partner, John, at the time was building a new house, and we built a big 3-bay garage onto the house, and that's where we had the stock cars for years.
Hmm.
And then after John died, I added a big 2-bay on the back side of the 3-bay. So we had...
Do you do anything small? Skydiving?
I try not to.
Yeah.
Speaking of sky, I've always wanted to go...
Ziplining?
I've done that. We did the one in Haiti.
You went to Haiti?
Yeah, on a cruise.
Jeez, I got a lot to unpack here today.
And that was the second largest zipline in the world.
Wow.
At the time. And my wife and I both did that. She got stuck.
What?
Well, she...
That's the worst nightmare I could imagine.
She didn't get... she wasn't straightening out enough, so it slowed her down, and she didn't go all the way to the end. But they have ways they get her.
Was there a language barrier between you and the Haitians?
Well, it's not the Haitians that were running it.
Oh, okay.
That was all gated off.
Okay.
From the resort area where we were, but that was great.
Zip line. So what do you want to do? Bungee jumping?
Yes. I'd love
You are psycho.
I love to bungee jump.
Really?
I don't know if the dogs would agree with two new knees or not.
Yeah.
But
well, it's a good way to test them out.
Yeah, I don't think...
you got a warranty on those suckers?
I feel like when the elastic takes up, it's very gradual.
Really?
I don't think it's a... You don't just stop.
That's what freaks me out. Yeah. I would do all the other things. I've done parasailing, skydiving. I've done some zip lines, but nothing like you.
Yeah. I think it would bring you to a slow, I think the transition has got to be slow. That's what I think. I've never talked.
Well, you get back to me on that, all right?
But I would like to try it.
Yeah. So you have the Garage MCR. Whose idea was it to call it MCR? Where did those? I mean, I understand. I know McCann Randall.
Yeah, but we just discussed it and thought that would be a good name.
There's a band called My Chemical Romance. I don't know if you ever heard of them, but their initials are also MCR.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were pretty big about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago.
And Max Cookson Racing is MCR.
Yes.
And I am a big fan of Max Cookson.
He's a nice guy.
He does all these nice things, you know, with autistic people and anybody he would help out, I think.
I think, have you met him in person?
No, not yet.
He's a really just wise beyond his years individual.
Yeah.
You know, just, I mean, you and I probably as teenagers would not be at the level that he is, you know, I mean, just attitude wise, he's, like you say, giving back and you know, it's one thing to go and to receive the accolades and achieve the things,
right.
But it's what you give back is what really, I think, is going to be your legacy.
Yeah, he's a super nice guy, I think. In fact, I called him one day and he answered and, you know, he said, you know, come on up sometime. I just haven't done it yet.
We should go up together and do like an MCR connection. Because when I would see that on Facebook, I'm like, MCR, the first thing that comes to mind, being a Sanford kid and a fan of yours, is MCR.
I keep wanting to, you know, on Facebook, explain that to him. You know how we.
Oh, because he probably doesn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just haven't done it.
But. Well, Max, this is the original MCR we're talking to right here. So Bob Randall is our guest, and we've, you know, that's what I love about Open Trailer is like it's just open concept. Or, you know, there really isn't a chronological way that we need to go with these things. But I do want to bring it back to racing. You get that late model in 1976. And. What kind of success do you guys have?
The first year in late model, I think Bob Babbs told me, you really made me nervous.
Yeah, well, he was the champion that year.
Yeah, and I had a hard time figuring it out.
Hmm.
But the second year, I got most improved driver.
Yeah, what did that mean to you?
Oh, I was tickled, you know.
I've always felt weird about most improved. I mean, it's great to be recognized, but like I've always thought, doesn't that mean I just stunk the year before?
Yeah. Well, I knew that I did.
Yeah.
But and it because in 79, I think it was when I won my first championship. But I was like. Fourth, I think, in 77. And George Babb was ahead of me in points. And then we got looking at the points. And there was there was one night that they didn't credit me my points.
The whole night?
Yeah. And when it was all said and done, I moved ahead of George. Well, moved me to fourth or something in the points.
Yeah.
In 78, I think it was.
Was Bob Babb Sr. Helpful to you guys? Or was there anybody that, you know, you're new and you're not, I mean, when you think of the late model division of that time, you have, you know, guys from Scarborough, guys from Wyndham, you know, guys from Buxton. Sanford's a little bit out there. Do you feel like you're an outsider?
No, I never did. You know, it almost seems to me that Bob Babb helped me when I had the Daredevil car.
Hmm.
You know, I didn't know anything about Stagger and this and that then. And I think he told me, you need to put some more Stagger in the car. So we did. And eventually we figured it out, you know, the big wheel goes further than the small wheel. You know, I'm sure there was a lot of guys. My memory is waning.
I don't know, man. You're pretty sharp. You're pretty sharp to remember that copper was flying out of the, just driving home, yeah. And you remember that.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first win in the late model?
I do. It was super. The first win that I felt I got, they said I didn't win. I mean, it was everybody in the grandstand, in the pit area, thought that I had won it, but every people in the grandstands thought that Dave Davo had won it.
Why was there a difference of opinion?
Well, it was just that close.
Mm.
And I don't remember if he was passing me or I was passing him, but he was probably passing me.
Do you remember the closing laps of that race?
No, I don't.
No.
Just the last lap.
Yeah.
Or just the finish line. It's all it.
Just get me to
mind.
The finish.
Yeah.
Getting out of the race car, what was the fan reaction? It was semi-controversial.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't remember that, but, you know, it was, like I said, the pit area thought I won. The grandstands were mixed.
Yeah.
It was close.
Sometimes.
And they looked at it. I don't think they had videoing equipment back then. You know, they
just a couple of judges. And,
yeah.
And
yeah.
Oftentimes race fans, even today, will see what they want to see.
Right.
And Dave Darvo, who's been on this podcast, he had a huge, or still has a pretty huge fan base.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, they want that favorite guy to win. But, you know, I think there's something to be said for the new person, and you were new at that point, to jump in and pick up that win. So you get that monkey off your back because you've been competing for a few years,
mm-hmm.
and you get that win. When does the next one come?
I think I won my first championship without winning.
In 79?
Yep. A race.
Now, tell me about how that happens.
Well, just being consistent and, you know, finishing somewhere near the front every time. And
it's something that I think is pretty consistent in Beatridge history. You know, a guy who came a few decades after you, Chris Smith, in the sports series, would do the same thing. I mean, it was a pretty large field, 25, 30 cars every single week. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying he purposely took second a few times, but in the back of his mind, he knew that consistency was more important than going out there and, you know, picking up the short gain, big win.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I knew that. Sometimes it's hard to do. You know, sometimes you want to.
Did you ever give away a race?
Boy, not that I can think of. I can remember having them taken from me from foolish wrecks, you know, without naming any names. But
well, you can name names if you want.
Well, there was one time where I was lapping cars. I was leading, you know, and this was when Kurt Gehry was driving.
Oh, wow.
For Larry Daniels' car.
Jim or Kurt?
Kurt.
Kurt. So he must have been real new.
Yeah, and I was lapping him at, I think I was going underneath him, and he got into me, and, you know, we wrecked the car and didn't win the race, obviously.
Yeah.
But
so this is Clay days at Beatridge. How do you get around the racetrack? What's the best way around Beatridge?
You know, that seemed like my car, the rougher it was, the better it liked it.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're in the potholes and everything.
Oh, yes. Yep. That car, you know, we'd bounce through those holes and keep going. And, you know, I enjoyed the clay other than scraping it off the inside of the car every week, you know,
yeah.
A 5-gallon bucket of it.
Yeah. Well, that would add weight over time.
Oh, yes.
I assume,
certainly.
Yeah.
We learned that.
Who's helping you at this point besides John?
Oh, we had Dave Palmer.
Is that any relation to Danny?
No. Mike Palmer.
Okay.
Excuse me. Yeah. Mike Palmer, Mal Graffam.
Oh, yes. Another Beatridge Hall of Famer.
Yep. And he definitely, you know, he was the crew chief. You know, he was the one that put it together. Him and I, you know, we would figure out what we wanted to do. Mm. You know, I was always hands-on in the setup, but then, you know, Mal got, so once we get the car going good, Mal could do it all himself.
So tell me a Malcolm Graffam story.
Oh, God.
Something that you don't think that, I think the modern day Beatridge fan would know him as the tech guy. Right?
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, even before he was working with you, he was a winning race car driver, but, you know, a behind-the-scenes mechanic who had quite the reputation.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he was funny. He hated the sight of blood. He'd pass out if he cut himself.
Really?
And one time we were in the garage and we were working, not on the race car, but it was in the winter, we were fixing his snowmobile trailer, and he tried to pick the axle up. I think he did pick it up, and somehow it cut his hand, and we were looking at it, and the next thing I know, he's on the floor.
Why are we laughing? That's funny. Yeah, it's funny now.
He hated needles. He didn't like sight of blood.
Yeah.
But he was a great, great guy. You know, I really miss Malcolm.
Yeah, he was he's a good man, very unique. And I know another person that you miss, especially from that era, was John. You know, I mean,
John,
you win your first championship in 1979.
Yes.
And you approach 1980 trying to back that up. And John's going through his health issues. What was that like for you as a team?
I mean, it was pretty devastating for me. I mean, he died on his wife's birthday. You know, we were done racing at the time, and every day we'd have to go into Mass General, because that's where he ended up, where they removed all the lymph nodes, you know, from this melanoma, and they sent him home and said he should be fine. They said they didn't even want to do any radiation on him. And, I mean, a week later he was back in there and passed away shortly after, you know, came back with a vengeance. And,
Yeah. Was this something that had been going on for a number of years?
No.
So the onset was pretty...
He had a mole on his back, and it had been bleeding, and he had been going to a local doctor, and the doctor was putting acid on it, trying to burn it off, which, you know...
Yeah.
And Dr. Rainforth, who was a good customer of ours, came in the garage one day, and John said, "Could you come in the bathroom here a minute? I want to show you something on my back." So we went in and looked at it, and he says, "Get to the hospital now." And he went up there and
took
it off, but he says it was stage 3 melanoma at the time.
And he's 35.
35 years old, yeah.
Wow.
When he passed, he'd have been 34 when they discovered it, I think, and 35 when they died, because I believe his birthday is December 11th.
Can you, if you wouldn't mind, dig into some of the emotions on racing in 1980 with the weight of that information on your race team?
Because we missed him, but we were still all into it, you know.
Was he going to the races in 1980?
I don't remember him going much at that point.
Was he your closest friend?
Yes, he was. Yeah.
So your best friend, your business partner, and you're fresh off your first championship, but you also back it up in 1980.
Yeah, and that was for him. I mean, that 80 championship was for John.
That was all sorts of emotions and kind of heavy in places. We lighten it up a bit in stage number two. There's some other cool stories that Bob gets into, like this one.
Yeah, Junior Hanley, 91.
Yeah.
1991. No one was beating Junior Hanley except for you.
Yeah. Well, he had an issue. And I remember he came back on the track. He'd gone pitted. They'd put tires on it or something. Mm. But he was down some laps. And he was coming up behind me. And I understand Tom Curley said, don't mess with him,
mm-hmm.
you know. And
to you or to him?
No, to him.
Okay.
So anyway, I won the race. I was amazed.
Bob Randall, stage number two, next time out on Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin. Thank you for tuning in.